Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Good morning. Good Sunday morning. Rick Moore is off today. This is Sean McCord, your friendly neighborhood monthly host. We are doing a doubleheader today of the wake-up call. We have a live guest in studio we'll get to in just a moment. And then at noon, we're going to be doing a pre-recorded show from last week with my friend Katie Gary, UVA drama lecturer, UVA drama graduate, who talks about... we had a really nice conversation about a life in the arts and applying arts to your career and to life and to business decisions. So stay tuned at noon for Katie Gary. But right now, our live in-studio guest is my old friend, Waldo Jakewith. Good morning, Waldo.
Good morning. It is a good morning. It's beautiful.
It is.
It's beautiful.
I
left my house. It was gray and dreary. I looked at a national satellite map, and the whole country is covered in clouds, and I thought, there's no way. And then I get to town, and it opens up. It's like the Wizard of Oz when it goes color. It's beautiful.
on Christmas Day, when we were all opening up our windows and rolling up our shirt sleeves here in Virginia, my family and friends in California were posting pictures of them, and, you know, in their woolen caps and their down jackets, you know, walking forlornly along the beach.
I use Christmas night as my occasion to subtly discuss global climate change with extended family.
And thank goodness it's a hoax, right?
Thank goodness.
Because otherwise, I don't know about you, but I'd be very, very worried.
I'd be troubled. Yeah. A friend of mine, Iranian-Mexican friend, is visiting his abuela in Texas last night, and he's posting photos of his grandmother in the snow. It's just snowing in Texas, and like at the time it was maybe 65 here in Charlottesville.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so welcome. So you and I, we go back, I don't know, 15 years or so. When did you run for city council?
Oh, run for being a euphemism for lost.
Well, yes, but you ran.
The moral of the story was get three more friends to vote. That was my message. That would have been 2002.
Okay, so so early 2000s, and you were a much, much younger man at the time.
22, 23, something like that.
As were we all. So you and I have, you know, our being Charlottesville, our circles keep overlapping.
Oh, sure.
What the conversation that you and I always have is about technology, because this has kind of become, you know, apart from family and our personal life, this is kind of what we've ended up doing with our career.
Sure.
And you're always doing some interesting project. And right now you are the director of the U.S. Again, help me get the title right.
U.S. Open Data.
U.S. Open Data Agency or U.S.
Nope.
Open Data Institute.
Used to be, we dropped it.
It's just the most
generic name we could possibly gin up.
Right now,
I want my organization to be not noticed or noted.
So then that's a perfect fit for community radio. but tell me a little bit about U.S. Open Data and what you're doing right now, and then we'll go back and sort of fill in what brought you there in the first place.
Yeah, sure. So U.S. Open Data is an organization that I established two years ago next week. We got started January 2nd of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
I had previously been with the White House Office of Science, Technology, Policy working on Open Data.
Okay, you said that just a little bit fast there. The White House? Which White House is that?
The
White House on the Hill? The White House down in the Valley?
Barack Obama's White House.
That White House.
The big one in
D.C.
The big one.
Okay, all right.
Office of Science and Technology Policy.
So you were working for the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House.
Yes. On Open Data. They have thousands and thousands of people work for the White House, and I was the least important person there.
No, I knew that, but I love the fact that you can say that.
When was my kid born? 2011, 2012, I was there working on Open Data. And when I had left for a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation that I'd actually received before I started with the White House to actually put that to work on Open Data. And when I finished up with the work with that grant, the White House had asked me, we would really like, could you please keep doing work in Open Data. We'll explain what that is in a sec.
You're just dangling it.
I'm just dangling because it's so fascinating sounding. I know it's gonna keep people listening. and asked if I would start an independent organization to help government. You know, it's a funny thing that I learned. I had assumed that working for the White House makes you powerful and you can get things done. And that is the opposite of the truth. Everything that would be so much easier to do in the private sector takes, without exaggeration, 10 times longer to do. The one power you have is the power to convene. You have the power to say, hey, you should come to the White House and we'll talk about this thing. And anybody will come when they're invited.
Yeah.
So that's it, though. That's like the power to convene is all you have. So they had asked that I start this organization, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation was interested in backing it. And I had enough connections in the nonprofit sector that we started this organization to work with government at a federal, local, state level and regional organizations as well, to help them figure out what information that they have that is valuable that they're not sharing that they should be.
That, there you go. That summarizes open data right there. So what is data, and then what is open data?
Sure. So data is, anything you have on your computer or your phone, for instance, that's data. But I imagine most of what is on your computer and your phone, you would not want to be shared with people. That's private. Open data is data that is explicitly at the time of creation on forward meant to be shared. So in fact, you know, just a few minutes ago, I'd mentioned that I was able to look at the radar map of the country, the satellite map, to see the conditions, to see that it was cloudy across the whole country this morning. I could do that because the prime example of open data is the National Weather Service.
Right.
So the National Weather Service was started by President Grant. He established it because we needed, the original name of the organization was something like the National Telegraph Weather System for the Benefit of Commerce or something like that. ships kept sinking, particularly in the Great Lakes and the Atlantic, because there were storms coming. And nobody knew about it. But the onset of telegraphy meant that news could move quickly. You could receive a message by telegraph from Ohio saying there is a terrible set of storms moving east. Hey, Washington, D.C., you should look out. And the harbor masters could alert the owners of ships, depending on the weather, to move their ships in or out of harbor, depending on what was coming, and save a fortune, both in lost goods and in lives, of course.
So when Al Gore claimed to invent the internet... We really need to go back further to U.S. Grant.
In fact, by some estimates, you go all the way back to the onset of the U.S. Census, the notion that you should be counting everybody, where they are, where they live, who's in their family. But there was no data then. Data is distinct from information. Information is anything you might choose to write down or record on a computer or what have you. Mm-hmm. But data flows freely. Data can move as bits. So that's what telegraphy made possible. So we came up with this National Weather Service, which was run by the U.S. Army, by the way, not because it was military, but because in the 1860s, nobody else in the government had their act together adequately to actually record weather and transmit it in any reliable way except for the military.
Well, in the 1860s and following the Civil War, there wasn't much of a U.S. government.
Yeah, it was kind of a mess. So General Grant took things over there. And so ever since, we've had this concept of weather data as a national good. And so beginning in the 1970s, you could dial up on your modem. You could dial up a 202 number in Washington, D.C. with your computer and connect to the National Weather Service's computer and download weather data. And so that might be the current temperature in every county in the country, or it might be forecasts or what have you. And then they move that onto the web. And so that's where the data flows from now. So I have 7 weather apps on my iPhone. Maybe it's addiction. I'm not quite sure what my deal is. So it's possible for me
to keep popping up different ones, trying to get better weather.
Well, sometimes actually that does happen. But you know, there's no private weather data. There's no like commercial weather satellite. I remember maybe 2010, when the Tea Party was attended in Congress.
I know the story. Please continue. I love this story.
Which congressman was it?
Let's say Inhofe.
Sure, but it sounds good like that. Introduced a bill saying, let's eliminate the National Weather Service and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, because NOAA and NWS, they don't do anything. We have the Weather Channel.
We have the Weather Channel.
And the Weather Channel responded by saying, where do you think we get our weather data from? There are no private weather satellites. It all comes from the federal government. And he very quickly withdrew that bill, because that's where all of our weather data comes from. I have one weather app called Dark Sky. All it does is it combines the National Weather Service data with GPS Another example of open data. That's a government program that has dozens of satellites orbiting the Earth at all times. All that they do, by the way, is they broadcast the current time. That is all that every GPS satellite does. And your phone...
GPS stands for...
Global Positioning System.
Thank you.
And the job of your phone is to receive that current time from a few satellites, see what the difference is, mm-hmm. and that will tell you how far away those satellites are. And by knowing their orbits, it can calculate exactly where you are. It's an incredibly simple system. So this...
not entirely, because they have to take in the fact that they're away from less... away from the Earth, so there's less gravity, so they have to...
Relativity comes into play.
Relativity comes into play.
Yes,
right,
yeah.
Right. Einstein's theory of relativity made GPS positioning possible, which I find fascinating.
And GPS helped to prove the accuracy of Einstein as well.
Exactly.
But there are very few systems that do as much as GPS that are as easy to explain. We put clocks in space.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's that's all that it does. So using this amazing technology, what am I doing with it? I have a program on my phone that combines the GPS data mm-hmm. with National Weather Service data that tells me it's about to rain. You should go inside. Or the rain is stopping. It's called Dark Sky. I paid like $2 for it.
And does it ping you?
It does.
Does it send you a text?
Yeah. It just vibrates on my phone. So if like, oh, I gotta go cover the compost pile or you know whatever it is that I just do before the rain comes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the sort of thing that's possible when government takes this data and publishes it. So if there was no weather data, if it was just weather information, what that would look like would be like a
Farmer's Almanac.
Well, yeah, but I'm imagining like something like that, but daily. So like every day, the National Weather Service like hand delivers pieces of paper to every courthouse in the country and nails it to the door. They say, like, this is going to be the weather today. And if you did that, there would be no weather apps.
Mm-hmm.
Like that wouldn't be possible. That information would only exist in the form of that piece of paper. But by rendering it as data, it's possible for people to do anything that they want with that without any limitations. You don't have to pay the government to use that data. You don't need to give them... They don't have to give you permission. You don't have to give them credit. You can do anything you want with it. And so that is open data. That is unlocking the power of that data. If the government held on to it, we would be missing out on... I think the most recent estimate I've seen for the value of weather data is about $80 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably rather more than that. Because if we didn't know when a hurricane was coming... I mean, just imagine the damage of like another Hurricane Andrew that was a surprise. So it's really valuable stuff.
You know, I think about that actually surprisingly a lot because we live in this connected age and, you know, we will get warnings 2 or 3 days ahead of time, you know, so many such possibility of this kind of weather coming or, you know, or a thunderstorm or a blizzard. And, you know, so we prepare ourselves, we run to the store, we buy milk and whatever. And especially living in a town like Charlottesville with so much history, knowing how critically important this was to our predecessors, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, when they had to deal with crops and you know, your daily life. And here we are going, oh, you know, there's a storm a-coming. I hope we don't lose our electricity.
Yep.
And it really helps to give you sort of perspective on, and I'm glad that we're talking about weather because this is a sort of a perfect example of how connected we are all the time, how important this kind of data is to us, and how easily we overlook it or we don't think about the fact that it's there and available to us.
And using that data by sharing it with weather data with the public, forecasts have gotten so much better.
Mm-hmm.
Just since Katrina, today, using the same data, and I saw the simulation run about a year ago, that was available to forecasters in 2005, we would now know that Katrina was going to weaken to whatever it did. I think it was a 5 just before it hit, and I think it weakened down to like a 2 or something when it hit. And then, of course, the real damage was as it made landfall and moved farther in, the next day is all the water washed back towards the ocean. We now know that. That's now totally forecastable in a way that wasn't then. By having so much data, we've been able to run more and more simulations as computing power gets better. That data is really, really useful. It saves lives.
So that's data, and that's open data. What? Tell me about the U.S. open data. I keep wanting to call you an institute.
I understand. We used to be.
U.S. open data. What is the goal of U.S. Open Data, of which you are the director.
Sure. So, unusual thing about the organization, it has a four-year lifespan. We have to go away after 4 years, or else my board has committed to publicly ridiculing me. the goal is to make the organization unnecessary, and I think 4 years is a good time horizon to do that. So, our job is to work with governments to help them figure out what data they have that is valuable and how to publish it in a way that is useful to people. And that's hard for them to do. It's tough for governments to understand what they have that is useful that they should be sharing but aren't, and how it could be valuable to people inside government and outside of government.
This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with my guest Waldo Jakewith. We are talking about data. We're talking about open data, and we're talking about his endeavor, his enterprise. U.S. Open Data. So, how much work do we have ahead of us? To give me some examples, maybe here in Virginia,
sure, of
good examples, and also maybe some bad examples. Good examples of how having open data from the government is helping commerce, is helping residents, and maybe some examples of what more we should be doing.
So here's some work I did that culminated about a year ago that resulted in stories in the Daily Progress and Civo Weekly covering this as well. So Virginia, like all states, registers corporations in the state. There's a list of corporations the state maintains. If you want to have a corporation, what that means is you've gone to the state and said, hey, Virginia, I want to call myself this thing, and here are the people that comprise the members of that thing that control it. And they say, yes, for the next 1 year, you can call yourself that in exchange for you giving us money.
Right, and you get some kind of tax status.
So as a part of that, you also need to register with your locality so that you pay business license taxes. And not all localities in Virginia charge that, but most do. So I had started freeing that data for Virginia. So in Virginia, when the State Corporation Commission creates that list of all corporations, which they update once a week, they sell it. It costs $150 a month. I find that offensive, the notion that you would sell that data. So just for fun, out of pocket, I started paying $150 a month to buy that data and turn around and give it away. That is, I wrote a script that would download the data from their site at 2:01 a.m. on Wednesday morning, a minute after they updated it, and upload it to my website at vabusinesses.org and give the data away for free, and basically daring them to sue me.
Well, and that's the obvious question is, was that legal, what you were doing?
Unclear. I say absolutely it was legal, and I would be very happy to go to court to defend that. I just haven't had that opportunity. But I will say that there are certainly those who would say that it is unclear whether it's legal. But that's, you know, right now Virginia does not give away that data for free. They sell it. And I think that's problematic for a whole host of reasons.
I want to continue that story in just a moment. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
It is Sunday morning. Wake up, everybody. It's the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. This is Sean McCord. I am talking with my friend Waldo Jakewith. And you're telling us a story about getting data about corporations and making that from the state and making that publicly available.
Yeah, so I had no experience with Virginia corporate data. It sounded pretty boring to me. I only started buying it and giving it away because it angered me that they were selling our data. It's our data. You know, our taxes pay for the state to gather this data. Why are they selling
it? So our taxes are paying for the state to gather this data, and the only way to get this data is to pay $150
a month. Yeah, you have to sign at least a 3-month contract.
Right. And who was paying for this? Anybody?
I FOIA'd the list from the State Corporation Commission. I was customer number 7. So this is, just to be clear, this is a hugely money-losing endeavor. The cost of the whole billing contract administration process surely exceeds, and I'm working on FOIAing that next, surely exceeds the income they generate from this. It's absurd.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, LexisNexis is one of the customers. It's business data companies like that that they buy. And
so LexisNexis was buying this information, and I'm just going to guess here, they weren't turning around and giving it away for free.
No, they sell it for a fortune.
Right.
They sell it for a fortune.
Right.
Yeah. So I took that data and started giving it away, and then I decided I would upgrade it. The data is horrific. It was probably pretty cool in maybe 1979, how modern it was. It was just terrible. So I spent months writing the free open source software. Anybody could download the software, use it, and then feed this data that I give away into it, and it would spit out really nice data that you can load into a spreadsheet or any modern software. And so along the way, I started uploading that data to the web and you know, just telling people about it. I heard from the an employee of a large town in Virginia, which will remain unnamed because that's their preference, who said, hey, could you give us a list of all the businesses that are in our town? And I emailed back, so I guess I could if I, you know, because I have the addresses, and if I could geocode all those addresses and know where they are physically, then I could do that. But why do you need that? You know where the businesses are, because the person who wrote me was worked on the team that collected the local business license taxes for this town.
Right.
So that seems redundant. And she said, no, you don't understand. When a corporation registers with the state doesn't tell us that they say that they're in our town. We have no way of knowing who's supposed to pay business license taxes until they actually send us the first payment. We have an unauditable system. So I thought, oh my God, okay. So I reached out to the state's geography department, the geographic information system team for the state, and said, hey, do you have software that I can use where I can feed it a list of addresses and it will give me the latitude and longitude? And Virginia is one of the very few states in the country that does that. They have free software anybody can use. Unlike the State Corporation Commission, who sells that,
right,
they give it away. So because they give it away, I was able to feed it, I think it worked out to about 12 million addresses.
Wow.
Over the course of 11 days. And I had the latitude and longitude then for every business in the state.
Now, did they call you back up and say, dude, you're burning up our servers?
No, I trickled the requests in over the course of 11 days to keep from burning up their servers. Yeah. I didn't want to make any enemies there.
So just a million a day.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a lot. But, and they didn't even notice. I asked later, I was like, so is that a problem? They were like, what a problem? We didn't even know. So then I had the latitude and longitude of every business in the state, and then I used existing open data of the boundaries of every town and county and city in the state. And so I created this on this website at vabusinesses.org. You can click to download a spreadsheet of every business in any town or county or city in the state. And so I sent this to this town, and they said, great, we're going to use this to conduct an audit. For the first time, we can figure out who isn't paying taxes but is supposed to be.
Right.
Well, this never occurred to me. You know, I stumble through life doing things that seem like they might be interesting, and later on, people are like, that was brilliant. This is definitely one of those where I had no idea this was ostensibly brilliant. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to the Commissioner of the Revenue for the City of Charlottesville, with whom I'm acquainted, and said, hey, could you give me a list of all of the businesses in Virginia that pay business license taxes?
In Charlottesville,
you know, right, within, not in Elmore, but just within the 10 square miles of the city. He said, sure. And he sent me that list, and I wrote some software to audit it. And it turned out that one third of all businesses that exist in the city, the state knows about, but the city doesn't know about, which is to say about one third of all tax revenue that the city should be collecting from business license taxes, they're not getting.
Now, to be fair, these weren't necessarily all scofflaws.
Nope.
Some people could have registered a business and then it never took off, or you know, or it has since closed. I mean, there could, and also because this information was so difficult to gather in the first place, not for you, but for other people, they might not have been aware of all the hoops that they had to run through.
I have a corporation. It's just a shell corporation used for signing contracts, but I have a corporation that is registered at a P.O. box in the city. Right. I don't know if I'm supposed to be paying business. I showed up in my own audit. I don't have the faintest idea if I'm supposed to be paying any taxes on this.
Right.
Because I don't do anything with it. It doesn't conduct any business. And there's also some forms of business, like a church doesn't have to pay any business license taxes. Insurance companies are regulated by the state. And so if you run an insurance agency, you don't have to pay any business license taxes to the city. That said, the city is probably missing out on somewhere between $1 to $3 million dollars worth of revenue every year. And the law lets them go back, geez, I think it's 5 years. To collect unpaid taxes. So we're looking at a one-time windfall of $5 to $15 million.
Now, when you register a business, and maybe you don't know this, but when you register a business, if do you have to renew that license regularly?
Every year.
And if you don't, then you're no longer considered?
The corporation automatically expires.
Got it.
Yep. And so Siva Weekly, they called a bunch of these people on my list who were listed with a state, but not with a city. And unsurprisingly, very few of them were interested in doing an interview with a reporter about why they don't pay their taxes. So their conclusion was, looks interesting, maybe it's valuable. So the city, last I heard months ago, was seeking funds from the city, or the, tax assessor's office was seeking funding from city council to conduct an audit. They've never had the money to have an auditor. So they're saying, look, somebody's done the research. We could potentially make a lot of money on this. So I've since heard from maybe six or eight localities across the state who are interested in this as well, who I've also given the data to, who said they're looking to conduct an audit. So I don't know how long to wait before I should start expecting results from that. But all of this is possible because the state has, the State Corporation Commission has data they sell, unfortunately, but they have that data and was able to get it. Because the state's Geographic Information Systems Office was able to let me use their geocoder so I could figure out where all those businesses were. And because the city was able to give me a list, because it's also open data, a spreadsheet, of all the businesses that have licenses with the city.
And let's be clear, when we're talking about data from whether it's you know regional, municipal, city, state, this is all data. We're not talking about state secrets.
No.
This is data that should be open, that our taxes in one form or another have paid for.
I don't want people's personal tax returns. Nobody's pushing for that. This is about information that you can FOIA. If you can file a Freedom of Information Act request to get this information, that's the sort of stuff that my organization is saying that should be available preemptively. In fact, I tell people in government that they should regard FOIA requests as a failure. Anytime somebody files a FOIA request saying, please give me this information, that's that government's failure to make it available preemptively. And if you're ever getting the same FOIA request twice, what are you doing? Mm. Just put it up on your website on the FOIA page. Put a link for people to download that data so they'll stop asking you for it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a really compelling argument for small towns for whom the time it takes to respond to FOIA requests, particularly from big companies like LexisNexis, they get a lot of the data, and this is big in the corporate world now. They'll file lots and lots of FOIA requests, such as who filed in response to your RFPs. If you've published any request for proposals in the last year for projects that are worth more than $5 million, give us the names of who bid on those.
Okay, so now for people who have only worked in the private sector, an RFP, request for proposal, is you've got a project coming up of some sort, and you are constrained. You are required to...
You have to bid it out.
Bid it out and get in a certain number, usually three or four or five or some number, so they can go to different vendors and say that, you know, you did due diligence and you are spending the taxpayers' money wisely and you're going to go for the company that can do this particular project most effectively, most efficiently, et cetera.
So you can imagine that for like investment banks, knowing what companies are making the most bids to the most cities across the country will tell you who's expanding aggressively and who you might want to invest in.
Mm-hmm.
So in finance, the use of both open data and FOIA requests, aggressive FOIA requests, even of small towns and counties, is making them a lot of money because it's really quick to file every FOIA request, but it can take a long time for a town to respond to that. So the argument that I've been making to some of these smaller towns, particularly in the Northeast has just a different form of government. We're here in the Southeast, we have like a big county with the occasional city and town that is maybe a little bit independent. Mm-hmm. But you go up to like Pennsylvania or New Jersey, Massachusetts, you go from one town to the next to the next to the next. Mm-hmm. Nobody even knows what county they live in. So there's all these towns. And for them, dealing with FOIA requests is exhausting. They hate it. So they love the idea that they can reduce their FOIA load by just giving away the data on the website in the first place, and people will stop asking them for it.
So why isn't everybody? Why isn't every town, every municipality, every state already making all this data publicly available?
It's a new concept. The phrase open data didn't exist until 5 or 6 years ago. So So there's one reason. Another is that it's a little bit scary. Like, mm-hmm. it's one thing if you're giving information to one person who requested it. Because if you're a government employee and you mess up in some way with an interaction with one person, you email them back, you apologize, you fix it. But if you get that data wrong, if you accidentally release private information and thousands of people download it, mm-hmm. will you get called before some subcommittee and humiliated and fired? So there's some potential large downside. One of the messages that my organization is spreading is that open data should not be about making data available to the public so that some random 20-something just out of business school can use that data to make a billion-dollar business. That's a really terrible incentive if you work in government to share data. But instead, it's more like, as we've been talking about with Virginia Business Data, if the state would just share data with localities, localities across Virginia could take in an extra maybe $100 million a year. I think that's on the conservative end, by being able to figure out what businesses exist there they don't know about. Government, by publishing data, can help government. And I think that's a much more compelling and less scary argument than give away your data so that some guy can get rich.
So, okay, so you've given an example of how just this, in this sort of small slice of data, you were able to take some data from the government and make it more available. Can you give an example, say here in the region or here in the state, of something, a nut that you would really like to crack?
Oh, it's nothing but nuts that need to be cracked. It's grim. We're always working on a bunch of projects like that. A passion project of mine right now, mm-hmm. That I hope to get started on in the new year, is parcels of land. And even as I say that, like, I don't even know, like, would 15-year-old Waldo be, like, excited to hear 37-year-old Waldo talk about this, or be, like, kind of bummed that 37-year-old Waldo was boring? But I think I can make a good argument as to why this is exciting. Knowing throughout the state, knowing throughout the country, what the boundaries are of every piece of land, who owns it, what it's assessed at, what its transaction history is, and so on, making that available on a vast scale is crazy valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, localities hold on tight to that. So if you're up in Fairfax, for instance, Fairfax, they sell that, and they sell it for a fair amount of money because they know that it's worth money to people to buy, you know, the equivalent of LexisNexis, but in the real estate space. If you can know the transaction history and the value of plots of land, that's something you can make a lot of money on. So if you're, say, McDonald's, McDonald's wants to be able to basically constantly ask this: where can we buy a parcel of land, and I'll make up some criteria, but you get the idea, that's between 2 to 5 acres, that's within no more than a 60-second drive from a highway that's at least 4 lanes, that costs no more than $30,000 an acre? Because if they can find that, that's where they want to put a McDonald's.
Right.
Right now, that's really hard for them to get the answer to that, and they spend a lot of money on it. Like, it's a vast inefficiency.
And I mean, I assume they send out scouts to go to a town and
they have all kinds of ways to do it. And they can get that data, but it costs them a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
because they have to get it from these data brokers that sell it for a fortune.
Mm.
What I would like to see happen is instead for every locality in Virginia to start aggregating that data and sharing it with the state, and for the state to have one file you can download, or even a map you can browse to look at that. You know, reporter friends of mine lament to me that when they want to do research on land ownership or zoning, which is a constant thing for a lot of reporters, the data ends at the county or city boundaries. So if you're a reporter for the Daily Progress and you're trying to do research of development matters, well, you're constantly flipping back and forth between the city's land map and the county's land map on their own websites. But the world doesn't actually work like that. Our interests don't end at municipal boundaries. So that's a project that I'm enthusiastic about that I think could be useful in ways that we can't really foresee right now.
It is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord talking with Waldo Jaquith about open data. So tell me...
Oh, I got a story for you.
Oh, please.
I got a story for you that I really like. There was a startup three years ago, I think they began. It was some Google guys.
Mm-hmm.
They realized that if they could take national weather data national crop data, because the federal government and state governments gather great detail on what crops are grown where, how much was planted, how much was produced, where they got the seed from.
And they're getting this information from the farmers and the farming
and from the seed co-ops and things like that.
Right.
And the farmers want to provide that data because they want to know, oh, God, we planted corn and everybody else planted corn, too. The value is going to plummet. We got to tear that up quick and put something else in. So it really benefits them for everybody to know that. So this company combined the weather data, that crop data, and soil data. The federal government has a lot of data on, with pretty fine granularity, of what soil samples from all around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So when I've taken a soil sample from my garden and sent it to Virginia Tech, I think that goes in a database somewhere of, all right, at this address, at this place, here's what the soil's like. So they combined these three big national databases, and they figured out that they could tell people in which field. Now, if you're a farmer, they'll tell you in which field you should grow which crop and on what day you should plant it.
Wow.
So the way they monetized that was this. They sold crop insurance.
Hmm.
So normally crop insurance is really important if you're a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, if there's a crop failure, you're not bankrupt, but there's some way to cover it. But it's expensive because if you have a crop failure, probably like all your neighbors do too, or maybe even the whole state. And so the crop insurance is federally backed, costs a lot of money. This company started a new crop insurance program that was way cheaper. The deal was just you plant what we say to plant when we say to plant it. They made a fortune on this, and they were bought by Monsanto. So it has a sad ending.
Oh, well.
For $1 billion, maybe 18 months ago. And that was the first billion-dollar company built entirely on open data. Now, they had to be very clever. They had to figure out how to combine those data sources to mm-hmm. do useful things with them. It was a non-trivial challenge, but they did it.
Of course, now Monsanto is turning around and saying, here's what you should plant, and we're going to sell you the seeds.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm sure they're designing seeds just for these climate conditions that they're ginning up here and then patenting them. And
yeah. So this actually touches on something, because we both, you know, if this is the radio, but our eyebrows both shot up when you mentioned Monsanto. You and I have both been involved in local politics. We're both liberal Democrats. Shouldn't open data be a nonpartisan issue? Shouldn't everybody across the board be supporting this? And are they?
Yes and no. So yes, everybody supports it generally, but the people who are enthusiastic about it are 10-1 liberal Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two reasons for this. So one is my conservative friends aren't even fans generally of open government things.
Right.
Because their position is that government is too big if you need any sort of open government data thing. That, like, that's a symptom of a government that is too large. So that's one reason for, like, a lack of passion. Another is the people who got into open data and really, like, it happened to become a thing just as President Barack Obama was coming into office. And he made a big part of his work as president in opening up government data. And that doesn't make it partisan, but when something is promoted by one particular president and one particular party, it can have that effect. The good news is there are some, and I work closely with a few conservative Republicans who are really enthusiastic about this and have taken strong leadership positions in making open government data a thing. The trick for us is going to be the next presidency.
Right.
Whoever wins this next election, we need to make sure that next president continues to push open data. And there have been public commitments so far from, I think, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and I think Hillary Clinton, that they all support some core aspects of it, which is a good sign. There's nothing partisan about open data or open government data, but it has had the accidental effect so far of being that.
We're going to take a quick break. It's the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel with 6 area locations.
Yeah, It is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, talking with Waldo Jaquith about open data. You have a story you wanted to tell about Daryl Issa.
Well, so I want to go back, 20 years. Well, about 20 years to when the city of Charlottesville was looking to pass a youth curfew.
Oh, I remember this.
And, I was a homeschooler. Like, I went to Western for a couple of years before it was just Western. My high school was just not for me, and dropped out and went to, like, a homeschooling collective downtown called the Living Education Center for Ecology and the Arts. And so I had plenty of time to do things like go to city council meetings. And I would go to every city council meeting. I would be the last person in the chamber when they would wrap up, and they'd all be looking at me, be like, does anybody have any public comments? Waldo, why are you still sitting here? I like being here. And so it was in the context of that, that when the city said they're looking at passing a youth curfew, I was furious. I was 17. I would have been covered by it. It would have made it illegal for me to go to city council meetings and stay until the end. Like, why? I don't understand. And they said it's because of crime. But they could only point to, I think it was like maybe 50 incidents of crime in the entire year before committed by juveniles during the covered hours. Most crime committed by juveniles is between 3 and 5 p.m. Right. They get out of school before their parents come home. It was just offensive on a bunch of grounds. And so I wanted to start doing some research into figuring out, well, like, what are they allowed to do this? What's already on the books? I didn't know the distinction between local law and state law and national law. So I went to the library, and they had a copy of the city code and a 3-ring binder. There was like pages were torn out and missing. And I knew there were laws that had been passed by council because I'd sit there and seen them be passed that were not, it was clearly had not been maintained. And so I had gone to Jeannie Cox, the then clerk of council, and I couldn't tell the story for a long time because I promised her that I wouldn't. But now that she's not holding the seat anymore, I can. I gone to Jeannie Cox and said, hey, so I have an idea. I would like to get a copy of the city code, but like on disk, so I can put it on the World Wide Web, because this is 1995, so that anybody can look at it. That seems useful. And she said, well, we don't have that. We get a printed copy from the company that we pay to maintain the code, the Mickey company, LexisNexis. But we don't have it electronically. And I said, well, could I get the book? And she said, well, yeah, but it's $120. Yeah, I'm 15, not $120. So I said, well, I can't. I guess I could scan it in. I didn't have a scanner, but like I could use one. And she said, well, you know, it's still $120. So could I borrow one? She said, I don't have one to borrow, but I can sell you one. And I said, I don't have the money. She said, okay. Don't tell anybody I did this. Here, you can have a copy of the. And she just handed me the printed thing. And so, again, I did not tell that story as long as she was clerk, as she was for a long time. So I had to bum the use of page feeding scanners from business owners around downtown Charlottesville. Like, hey, mister, can you spare a scanner? Got the whole thing scanned it in, and then used optical character recognition software to convert it all to text. Put it up on the web as HTML, set up a web page at personal.comet.net/TildeWaldo/laws or something. And then I realized within like a month, I had recreated the problem of the library website. Now I had a version of the laws online. They were also out of date that I had no capacity to keep up to date. And I thought, oh my God, I'm part of the problem. This is terrible. So fast forward years and years, I was building for fun a, God, this sounds absurd that I was doing this for fun, but it's true. A website for the laws of Virginia. The laws of Virginia had a terrible website, very difficult to browse and understand. And so I created software that would, make it way easier to search and read and, and would get like inline definitions. So if the word person had a special definition for the purpose of that chunk of the code, you could pass your mouse over that dotted word and see the definition. It was much easier to understand. People could post comments, that kind of thing. And I got funding.
Gosh, Walter, that does sound fun.
Well, I really enjoyed it. And so I spent months developing in like evenings and weekends. And then the Jonathan James L. Knight Foundation offered me a $165,000 grant to turn that software into a platform that could be used for any legal code. And so I spent a year and change developing that, and a software developer working with me on it. And that got turned into its own project, and a Congressman Daryl Issa, who listeners will know for long having head the House Oversight Committee and launched failed investigation after failed investigation into the alleged misdeeds of President Obama. He, in the meantime, had started with one of his staffers a nonprofit called the Open Gov Foundation that has two main things that they do, and one of them is developing, supporting, and deploying that software that I wrote called the State Decoded to cities and states across the country. And so I found myself with this extraordinary bedfellow, strange as they come, Congressman Daryl Issa. He and I working together, and the growing group of people who I work with every day at the OpenGov Foundation, which is, by the way, a ideologically diverse group in terms of its employees, both people who are very far left and very far right, working on opening legal data, making it easier for people to find out what laws govern them, because it's hard to find out right now. In fact, he sent me a tweet last week inviting me on a private tour of Congress.
And are you going?
Of course.
Of course.
I've never even set foot in Congress.
Really?
It never, like, as a kid, it just never happened. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to do that. It was amazing.
Nice. So Waldo. Bringing the right and the left together,
well, yeah,
under the umbrella of open data.
We just don't talk about politics. that's how we handle that.
So, but we touched a little bit about that on before the break. Talked about how people respond to the idea of government specifically and government data more narrowly based on their own sort of partisan leanings.
Yep. I sell it differently depending on who I'm talking to.
Well, tell me about that. Okay, so
sure.
So if I'm a small government conservative sitting
sure.
across from you now,
yep.
how are you going to sell me on open data?
Sure. So there's a few angles that I find effective there. So one is to say government is sitting on vast quantities of data that are worth a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And if you tell me about what you do, I can tell you data that is likely to exist that you just can't easily get that is going to make you more money or save you money. So there's one angle. Another is we're paying for this. Our tax dollars are going to government to create this data, and now they won't let us have it? You're going to stand for that? And another is the idea of modernizing our concepts of open government and freedom of information. That post-Watergate, a framework that made sense for open government was it's a right that meetings be held in the open. It's the right that you expect votes to be held in the open. It's that meetings will be announced in advance. That you can request copies of any documents that you want and receive them in a timely manner. In 2015, damn near 2016, that needs to be expanded to say you should expect that information will be provided preemptively without having to request it and be indexed by Google so that you can search for the information you want and get it instead of knowing there's a special person you have to go to and make a request of. What open government means today is not that you can go and ask nicely, hat in hand, and maybe get it if you use the right magic words, but instead it'd be available for everybody easily.
But Google is evil and they give money to Democratic candidates.
DuckDuckGo.com then, whatever your search engine of preference is.
Okay, so I'm still the small
government. The conservative, yeah.
Still the small government conservative. And I say, well, I don't want the government to have my data. I don't want to have to register my firearm.
Yep.
Because then when
the Russians come,
or more likely when Obama opens up his re-education camps,
any day now
they're going to come and they're going to come and take my Beretta.
Yep.
Or I don't want to give them my health care information because then they're going to use that against me and tell me I have to stop smoking,
uh-huh.
or tell me that I have to kill grandma. I'm trying to channel the small government conservative as I understand them.
Yes.
And look at healthcare.gov. I mean, that was a fiasco. The government tried to open up tried to get our healthcare information, and it crashed on the first day. So they can't do anything right. So why should we be giving them even more data?
So they're two responses available to that. So the first is that open data is not about collecting more. It's about giving away what we already have.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember a few years ago when the Roanoke Times created a web-only feature of they FOIA'd from the state. They got a list of every concealed carry permit holder in the state.
Yeah.
And they put up a site where you could look at a map and the names and addresses of every concealed carry permit holder. That went badly. And the General Assembly a year later passed a law closing that data down so it wouldn't be available. That by making data available, by surfacing it, we can figure out what government has that it shouldn't or that people can get that they shouldn't be able to and fix that. By hiding it, we allowed ourselves to pretend that it doesn't exist. So this is about getting that public so that we can fix it instead of pretending that the problem isn't there. Healthcare.gov was a private sector fiasco. Was outsourced to over two dozen companies, mostly through CGI Federal, a major federal contractor. Mm-hmm. And the fix to Healthcare.gov, the reason that it got better was because a bunch of the people who I used to work with got together in a hotel room in Columbia, Maryland, and said, we're not leaving until we fix this. Government employees, in fact, many of them were paid nothing. They weren't even government. They were just brought in to be like, let's pretend you're government employees now. Mm-hmm. And as a result of Healthcare.gov, both the U.S. Digital Service and 18F, which is a in-house developer of software for the federal government, were both started because the realization was that outsourcing core federal projects that are key infrastructure for our government is a really terrible idea. That it's something that you need to hire competent people to develop it, and instead of figuring that the private sector will work it out.
And giving it to the lowest bidder, or more likely to the contractor who already has an existing government contract and has been doing different kind of work for years and years, and has possibly given, you know, campaign money to certain, you know, heads of government Senate committees and so forth.
I remember when Healthcare.gov went live and just immediately failed, that whatever day of the week it was, you know, come that weekend, that's when the federal government flew in people from Google and so mm-hmm. on to say, like, you fix this. They started work like on a Friday. Saturday morning, they're still, you know, they're working all night because like the entire country is supposed to be signing up for healthcare and can't. And so they call, you know, it's 8 a.m. or whatever, Saturday morning, they call the people at CGI Federal. There's no answer. Not all weekend. They've gone home because, you know, it's a 9-to-5 job for them.
Right.
The whole country is waiting and needing this site to work so they can sign up for healthcare. And they're taking time off. It's just a complete difference in philosophy between a public service about wanting to do what's best for your country versus, it's a job.
Right.
And I don't mind people who say it's a job, but we shouldn't rely on them for core federal infrastructure.
But that's not the story. And I don't mean to harp on this, but yep. I think it's an interesting, fascinating example. That's not the story that's out there. The story that gets told is that Obamacare.gov launched and it immediately failed and government can't do anything right.
Yep.
And, you know, what?
Well, it's kind of true. Mm. The failure of government here was using the standard bidding process and working with the same idiots. And in fact, after CGI Federal cared, after they failed, the project, the response of the federal government was to give them more money. Oh, geez, here's another billion. I hope you can get it right this time.
Man.
And so when these people who came to work directly for the government came in to fix it, they moved everything onto Amazon's cloud service that they could. But mm-hmm. what really still slows the site down, like why still I went to sign up on the last day that you could just to say, yeah, I want to stick with my existing healthcare plan. I had to sit there with my browser open for 15 minutes saying, please wait in line to get into the site. That was this year.
Wow.
The reason is because the government can do all that they want, but ultimately these systems have to interface with private health insurers' mm-hmm. systems, mm-hmm. which are slow and terrible. Mm. The weak link continues to be not federal government, which is running a very sleek, modern, cheap system, so much cheaper than the mainframe. That's a word they actually use in 2015, these big vendors, not the mainframe systems they were using. Now the feds run it on these fast cloud-based systems, which is to say if there's more traffic, the system automatically starts up some new servers, sends the traffic there. More traffic, mm-hmm. starts up. Less traffic, it shuts them down.
Right.
It auto-scales. But these old-school systems that they have to interface with in the private sector are as bad as ever.
Shouldn't it be part of your contract with the government that if you're going to if you're going to be providing data, that you be doing so on open and scalable platforms?
This is a change that we're seeing. So this is the U.S. Digital Service is mm-hmm. a new part of the Office of Management and Budget that just got started a year ago, and they just received, I think it's $105 million in funding in the budget that the Congress just passed. The job of the U.S. Digital Service is to get competent people to come into government with strong backgrounds in technology and technology funding. And they embed them directly with agencies. So if, let's say, the Veterans Administration has failed terribly at some IT project, They'll be told
just for example. Just imagine that.
A lot. A friend of mine is the chief technology. He was placed by the White House as the CTO. Marina Martin is the CTO of the Veterans Administration now to help fix that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the VA is told, we're going to keep giving you funding, but here's a catch. You take our person to execute your projects now because you don't know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the strings that they start putting on. And then they start saying, all right, since you failed yet again, we're going to review all your contracts from here and out. And here's a new requirement. The software has to be open source. Your vendor, after they create that software for you, anybody else gets to use it, any other agency. We're not going to pay once per agency to redevelop the same system over and over again. It's a waste of money. So that's how we're starting to see real change happen in government, by the White House pushing competent technocrats down to these agencies. I guess technical technocrats at that, double technocrats down to these agencies, and insisting that their contracts be run in a reasonable way. And no more monoliths. Government has liked, at all levels, government likes contracts to say, listen, we know these are five unrelated things and we should bid them out to five different vendors, but that sounds like a lot of work.
Right.
So let's just bid it all out to one company and they'll figure it out. And what do they do? Well, they outsource it to five other places, and some of them outsource it to places, and you end up with terrible work that doesn't even work with each other.
So, as one liberal Democrat to another, Waldo.
Well, I'm more of a libertarian.
Does government work?
Government can work. Yeah, I mean, is it a fair point to be made that, like, the U.S. is one of the most functional countries in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is clearly working. Government can work so much better than it does now, and we're seeing ways that it can. There's a dangerous trap here where there's a philosophy that I've seen starting to come out in the White House. If we just get people from outside government in government, then things will be better. Well, No, that helps, but then they're in government. And how long are you in government before you're a problem?
Right.
That's the inherent philosophy there. Instead, what we need is a change in philosophy that celebrates people in government and that promotes the people who are doing good work. And that shines a light on how to do things better. And that's a big part of my job. It's a part of a job that I enjoy the most. The conference that I like talking, I don't even talk to the big tech conferences. I don't care. My favorite conference that I speak to every year is the National Association of Secretaries of State, of all U.S. states, has a subconference of the people who, administrative codes and records, the people who are in charge of new regulations in every state. I love their conference. They do great work. And I get to stand up in front of them and tell them, in all honestly, I'm a huge fan of your work creating regulations. How can I help? We should do more of that.
So U.S. Open Data, your initiative. How many employees do you have? How many people?
Me plus three other people. We'll be adding another three in February.
And so you're coming up on your second anniversary.
Yes, that's right.
And you're only going to exist for two more years?
At most.
Okay. How, other than it's 2 years when you've lost your funding.
Yep.
How do you know that your job is done, or at least that you've made a difference?
When people in government in powerful positions stop being surprised by what I tell them. I want them to be nodded. They're like, yeah, I know about Open Data. What else do you have to offer me? Oh, nothing. I'm done. Thanks. I'm finished with my job.
Excellent. So I know you're not here to promote US Open Data, but if people want to find out a little bit more information,
usopendata.org or opendata on Twitter.
Open Data on Twitter. Very cool. Walter, thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for coming in on Sunday of a holiday weekend. Coming up is going to be a bonus edition of the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with Katie Gary, a UVA drama lecturer and UVA drama graduate, who's going to talk about using improvisational theater techniques in life, in career, in business. You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel.